no sign of bullet wounds. This is astonishing. The conclusion is the guy died of a bullet wound, but the autopsy said no sign of bullets. I think the police might have been involved in this thing. I think the gun, which was never found, they never found out where it came from, could have come from an evidence locker.
I didn't know. I'd never been in a courtroom, so when I sat in the docket, he sat a car length away from me during the whole trial. Never got up and came and talked to me during any of the questions, anything in that courtroom, not once. If you've been representing police since the 60s, the Brockton Police Department, since the 60s, you don't need to wait to the third day of trial and say, oh, it just dawned on me that I also represent Detective Smith and Detective Lagarde. And, you know, you don't just remember that.
And that's the videotape that's got this bizarre edit in the middle of it that's entered as evidence in the court of Sergeant Bilko right at the most critical point in the videotape. All of a sudden, we see Sergeant Bilko from the 1950 sitcom.
He told them that, what are we talking about here? Jury of his peers. God knows none of you are his peers. This is a different community than what you come from. He told the jury that. What was the point of telling them that? That God knows you're not his peers.
In 1985, Darrell Jones was arrested for capital murder in Brockton, Massachusetts. Brockton is a town that has fallen on hard times. It was once the center of shoe manufacturing in the United States, but today, not a single soul rolls off its assembly lines. The pride of Brockton is Rocky Marciano, the only world heavyweight boxing champion to retire undefeated. And the bane of this city of 100,000 is a police department plagued with a long history of corruption. Jones was found guilty of the 1985 murder of alleged Cuban cocaine dealer Guillermo Rodriguez in Brockton, about 25 miles south of Boston. Jones, then 19 years old, was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The trial in which he was convicted hinged on evidence that was deliberately doctored by police, an all-white jury with an outspoken racist, and a defense attorney who refused to sit next to his client. It was a recipe for injustice. 1985 was a much different era than today. Madonna's song, Like a Virgin, neared the top of the Billboard charts. Like a virgin, touched for the very first time. Like a virgin. The movie The Breakfast Club was released.
A brain, a beauty, a jock, a rebel, and a recluse.
I can't believe this is really happening to me.
Before this day is over, they'll break the rules.
Chicks cannot hold a smoke. That's what it is.
Bare their souls.
I'm a nymphomaniac.
Are your parents aware of this?
Take some chances.
Being bad feels pretty good, huh?
And touch each other in a way they never dreamed possible.
Why'd you do that?
Because I knew you wouldn't. Oh.
The Breakfast Club.
And Rock Hudson became one of the first celebrities to die of AIDS.
Rock Hudson. Tonight, the 59-year-old actor remains in a Paris hospital undergoing tests, but the nature of his illness has become clouded in mystery and confusion. Yesterday, it was reported that Hudson had liver cancer and possibly AIDS. But today, the hospital denied the cancer story and said nothing about the AIDS rumor. A spokesman just said Hudson was tired.
For Darrell Jones, a 19-year-old African-American man living in Boston, it was also a time of transition. His girlfriend was pregnant with their second child, and he chose to travel to Brockton to drink at a bar known for serving those under the legal drinking age. It proved to be the biggest mistake of his life.
I just happened to be in the town, you know, coming, seeing a few friends and coming to hang out, and just happened to stop off at the area I was in, that particular bar, and next thing I know, you know, somebody's killed, and I'm inside the bar, I know nothing about it, and I'm in jail. You know, it just that quick, just that simple, you know.
Suspect Convictions founder Scott Reeder spoke with investigative reporter Bruce Gellerman with Boston National Public Radio affiliate about the case.
Somebody got shot and killed in a parking lot. Let's start from there.
Well, maybe not. You know, that's an interesting premise, but look, they never found shell casings. We have the shell casings. If somebody shoots somebody and falls in the street, there should be shell casings. Well, those aren't ever kept in evidence or entered as evidence. And then in the autopsy, which Jones's attorneys only got a few years ago, it says no sign of bullet wounds. This is astonishing. The conclusion is the guy died of a bullet wound, but the autopsy said no sign of bullets. So did he try? I don't know. I wasn't there.
So what do they think he died of?
Well, who knows? And, you know, the autopsy says he died of a bullet wound, a shotgun wound, but you know, where's the shell casings? One of the bullets supposedly fell out when they picked up the body, but that's it. And I'm not making this up. This is the evidence we found. So they died of a bullet wound, I guess so. They concluded that, but there's no sign of bullet wound, and there's no shell casings. This was the kind of sloppy detective work that was done in the case. This stuff would never, ever be allowed to be entered in the court. The way they interviewed the witnesses, the presenting the lineups of photographs. This is a monkey trial. But Darrell Jones was a kid. He's about 18 years old. He's in this bar. It's across the street from the bar. It's a parking lot. And in that parking lot is a sandwich shop. And Darrell Jones maintains he never went to that sandwich shop. That would be proved to be a very powerful piece of evidence or question if someone could ID him as being the person, because a few minutes later, that same person comes, according to the eyewitness, in the interview to the police, and he comes out with a guy from the bar and shoots the guy and runs off. So what we have is this. A guy comes out of a bar with a girl. He walks across the street to the sandwich shop, gets a sandwich, they all walk back to the bar. A few minutes later, that's supposedly the same guy walks back out with another guy. The other guy is significantly taller. That's what the witness says in the transcript of the deposition. And all of a sudden, the smaller guy shoots the bigger guy and runs off. The police are there in a few minutes because the police station overlooks the parking lot. They're there. The guy who dies is a drug dealer, supposedly. He was supposed to go to trial in a few weeks for earlier drug arrests in that same parking lot. It was a drug bust a year earlier. He was going to plead innocent. And Darrell Jones was in that bar. He says so. He says when the witness who saw the guy come out with the sandwich, come out with the guy and shoot him, he says the police brought him to the corner. He brought the witness to the corner, and he doesn't ID Darrell Jones there at all. The police, and this is from the investigative notes which we obtained, immediately, within 6 hours, had a confidential informant which they paid. And the confidential informant gives them all kinds of information about Darrell Jones, what kind of car he has, he's seen him, where he lives in Boston, just all kinds of information. And for the next 5 days, the police only look for Darrell Jones, and they wind up arresting him.
Police didn't have to look very hard for Darrell Jones.
You know, basically, what, maybe 2 weeks, maybe a week or two later I hear that they're supposedly looking for me, and I come back to the town to go to the police station to find out what they're talking about. You know, like, you're looking for the wrong guy. Why are you even saying my name? And that probably was the worst move I ever made, attempting to do that.
When the case went to court, things became even stranger. For starters, the attorney representing Darrell Jones refused to sit in the same section of the courtroom as his client.
Well, my attorney said that he likes to sit alone. I know it sounds crazy, and I was 18, just turning, and I didn't know. I'd never been in a courtroom. So when I sat in the dock, and he sat a car lift away from me during the whole trial, never got up and came and talked to me during any of the questions, anything in that courtroom, not one. I have no idea why the judge allowed it. I mean, when you look at Massachusetts law, that has been something that's not allowed since 1967.
If that behavior on the part of the attorney were not strange enough, he announced in the middle of the trial that several of the police detectives that he would cross-examine he had represented in the past.
I don't know why he waited to the third day of trial to say that he didn't know he represented the police when he's been representing them since 1965. And the cop that actually did this to me, he has represented him civilly, you know, one of the other cops against his wife and everything else. So he's been, if you've been representing police since the 60s, the Brockton Police Department, since the 60s, you don't need to wait to the third day of trial and say, oh, it just dawned on me that I also represent Detective Smith and Detective Lagarde. And, you know, you don't just remember that. You know what I mean? You know that you represent them.
But then things became even stranger. Police officers had videotaped an interview with a woman who said she witnessed the shooting. When the video was played for the jury, a key point in the interrogation had been taped over with a 1950s television comedy.
They wind up arresting her near the New Hampshire border, which is about 50 miles away one night. They bring her back. She's a prostitute and a drug user. They bring her back. They hold her without charging her anything. And the next morning, they videotaped her. It's the only videotape of a witness that they do. And Joe Smith is there. And that's the videotape that's got this bizarre edit in the middle of it that's entered as evidence in the court of Sergeant Bilko right at the most critical point in the videotape. All of a sudden, we see Sergeant Bilko from the 1950s sitcom in the middle of this videotape.
When the case went to the jury, things began to break down even more. Darrell Jones says when his attorney spoke to the jurors, he made matters worse.
Well, of course. What other message would you think if you would say, why is he not sitting with his lawyer? But my lawyer, you know, this particular lawyer, he did better than that. He told the jury, I mean, it's right there on the transcript, he told the jury that they weren't even a jury of my peers. This is an all-white jury. You know, older people, not young white people. Back, they were like in their 40s and 50s already. He told them that, what are we talking about here, jury of his peers? God knows none of you are his peers. This is a different community than what you come from. He told the jury that. What was the point of telling them that? That God knows you're not his peers.
The New England Center for Investigative Reporting interviewed juror Eleanor Urbati. She said she was the last juror holding out for not guilty. She said the judge's instructions when things were deadlocked to find a way to agree persuaded her to give in. It just seemed like everybody was against this kid for whatever reason, said Urbati. All I had to do was say no. I've been regretting it my whole life. Another thing that troubles Urbati, two jurors' comments that she deemed racist. On the first day of deliberations, she said both of them believed Jones was guilty. Because he's black? She asked. And they said, yes. They said, yes, the two men. How do you like that? The jury found Darrell Jones guilty, and the judge sentenced him to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Jones appealed his conviction and lost. But this year, in a post-conviction hearing, a judge threw out his conviction. In his order, he said he believed a police officer perjured himself when he said the videotape of the witness interrogation was accidentally edited. The judge also ruled that the racist statements made by a juror during deliberations were grounds for a mistrial. The conviction was thrown out and Jones was released from prison, but that does not mean he will be a free man. The prosecution may charge him again with the same crime.
So you have this guy, he's served 30-some years, he's been released, and your opinion is the Plymouth County District Attorney is cranking up to do another trial?
It would appear so. They haven't made a decision yet. I've asked them, are they prosecuting the case? They won't answer me. They've got a year to come up with an answer. That the clock started ticking in December of 2017, so they've got the next December to decide whether they're going to retry.
Something that was never presented to the jury in 1985 was the level of corruption within the Brockton Police Department.
I think the police might have been involved in this thing. I think the gun, which was never found, they never found out where it came from, it could have come from an evidence locker. The fact that a guy who had been arrested by the police for committing a drug offense, was going to go to trial in 2 weeks, was pleading innocent despite numerous attempts to get him to change his plea. That dies 2 weeks, is killed 2 weeks before his trial is interesting. You know, who's got an interest in that? I mean, it's circumstantial, it's conjecture, I'll give you that. But, you know, I do know that there was a huge amount of cocaine that was coming out of that evidence locker at the police station. I do know that there was a murder. Let's put it this way. It was a very suspicious death of a drug dealer who had met with police earlier. If I were investigating the case, I'd keep an open mind and start asking some damn hard questions of the police. That's what I would do. Now, could it have been Darrell? Sure. Could it have been anybody else? Sure. But, you know, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that suggests maybe you should look a little closer to home.
There was a lot of corruption in that department at the time. I mean, at least there was a reputation for it, just saying. And the chief of detectives became, who eventually went on to become chief of police, ended up going to prison. And what was the charges he went to prison on?
For stealing cocaine out of the evidence locker. He admits to it. I don't think he stole the cocaine. I honestly think, and this is me, this is conjecture, I can't prove it, but I find it hard to believe that this is the guy who took a kilo of coke and shoved it up in the nose. Nobody was looking at the 25 people. We have the logs, the evidence logs of the police signing out cocaine and never returning it. None of them, one of them is prosecuted, one, and he is exonerated. He's found not guilty, not exonerated. He's found not guilty. But that trial was a joke. I think that if you really looked at this, you might well look at the police. They had motive. They had opportunity. They had reason. And they controlled the investigation.
The chief of detectives at the time of Darrell Jones' arrest was Richard Sprowls. In 2016, he told the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, "What evidence is there that he did it?" asked Sprowls, 71. The court should take a hard look at allowing him a hearing to reopen the case. Sprowls pleaded guilty in 1990 to stealing drugs seized as evidence by the department. Following several investigations into drug-related corruption in the Brockton police force. Sprowls said in a recent interview that he was an addict and alcoholic in full tilt during the 5 years before he was caught in 1989, which included the period when police investigated and testified against Jones. Sprowls, who served 28 months in state prison, said he is speaking out because he knows firsthand what it is like to be incarcerated. He told Investigative Reporting Center, he is surprised that the district attorney's office decided to prosecute in light of what he now sees as a weak case. But when Scott Reeder spoke with Sprowls, he shared this.
I made a huge mistake when they first approached me on this case. And I spoke to people, and I got nothing but aggravation and more aggravation as a result of my having something to say. I can tell you this. I didn't know Darrell Jones, never saw him, never worked the case, never signed off on the case. Two detectives were assigned to it, Smith and Lagarde. Lagarde's dead now. Smith is alive. I can't help you out. I knew nothing about it. I told him that at the time.
Okay. But you said at the time you thought that he might be innocent. So that's just why I was giving you a call.
I think what I said was that after I reviewed the facts that fellow from the radio station in Boston had, that it appeared to be a very weak case. And it appeared to be a very weak case. I don't know how the DA's office ever got an indictment on a murder one on the evidence that was shown to me. That's the best I can do for you. Like I said, I don't know the guy. I never saw him. My signature or my initials aren't anywhere in that case. If they were, I'd own it. And I tell you,
okay.
I try to be a stand-up guy.
This is Scott Reeder, creator of Suspect Convictions. I'm joined today by our narrator, Michelle Ben-Simon, who's a Canadian musician and true crime buff.
Wasn't it a weird case, though?
It was very strange. And I mean, like a lot of the cases we see, it just seems like, again, no hard evidence and somebody gets put away for life.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that ran through my mind is, like so many cases we see, it's an African-American that this happens to.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, and I feel like at this, I don't even think it was just this time. kind of time period. I think it still happens so much today that these juries full of, unfortunately, people who, you know, are racist, and it plays such a huge part on how these stories unfold, and so much seems to be about race, and it's tragic.
This is an issue that I never really thought about when I was growing up. I grew up in a farming community in Illinois. It was fairly homogenous. I mean, there was an African-American population there and a small Hispanic population at the time. But it wasn't, you know, something that we spent a whole lot of time thinking about. And then when I was in college, I had an African-American roommate. And I watched the things that he went through every day that I never experienced. It was just unreal. I mean, the presumptions people would make about him just because of the color of his skin. One of the stories I always remember is that both of us had nieces about the same age, and we had pictures of our nieces above our study desks. And people would walk into my room, and they'd look over at his desk, and the first thing out of their mouth was, "Oh my God, he's got a kid." And the presumption was he must be a father at age 18 because he's African American and has a picture of a baby sitting over his desk. Nobody ever walked into my room and looked at my picture of my niece over my desk and said, "Scott, is that your daughter?" That never happened. That presumption was never there. But it's things like that that I think, you know, and if you were to ask me, those people who made those comments, were they being deliberately racist? Probably not. But the culture in which we were raised created those type of presumptions. And that, I think, taints a lot of things. Like when you have people in a jury, you'll have people who come in with different presumptions of what different types of people are like. And that is what's so scary to me. You know, this one juror said there were two people on the jury that said he's guilty because he's black. And it's like, where does that come from?
Yeah. And then this juror decided, like, had to comply with all of that, with all of them, and lives with that regret now, but still did it at the time, and was influenced possibly by, you know, what she was being told. And I don't really know what happened there with that juror. I mean, I can imagine you're under a lot of pressure, but I feel like it's your responsibility as a juror to stand your ground on what you believe in. In your kind of experience, do you find that a lot of jurors tend to be very impressionable and very, you know, somebody looks at them in a strange way and suddenly their whole opinion changes?
Well, I'll put it this way. There was this old judge when I covered criminal courts in Galveston, Texas. There's this old judge named Ed Harris, and he been there forever. I mean, he was the kind of guy, he was just kind of a good old boy, very good jurist in a lot of ways, very well educated, but he was very down to earth. When you go back to his office and talk with him, you eat shelled peanuts with him, and then he'd come out in the courtroom, and one of the things he told me was, when I was asking about juries, he said, "Scott, you know, I've never, in all the time I've seen jury selection, I've never seen the smartest person in the room pick to be on that jury. They never want people who really are bright and will think for themselves. And they, both sides tend to want people that will follow." And that's kind of scary. I mean, that's a lot of the thinking behind who we get onto juries. Now, you know, I've seen some very good juries. I've seen juries that were very impressionable. But I also, legally, I think we know that there's a presumption of innocence. We know that. That's what the Constitution says. That's what all of our case law says. But my experience from talking to jurors is when they see somebody coming in there and sitting down and they're thinking to themselves, well, there must be something against him. Otherwise, he wouldn't be on trial in the first place.
Exactly, which is similar to something we've talked about before with how police officers sometimes feel that way when they think, well, even if it's not this person probably did something that they should be committed for. They always have that presumption.
Exactly. I mean, I think we brought this up at the I think one of our last episodes. I had a friend that was a prison guard, and I was chatting with him. This is probably 15, 20 years ago, and I said, you know, Jim, have you ever seen somebody who you really thought might be innocent that was in prison? And he kind of looked at me and he said, well, here's how I look at it, Scott. If they're in prison for something they didn't do, they probably did something that they ought to be in prison for. And I think that's a really cynical and wrong way to look at it. But I think there's a lot of people in law enforcement that take the attitude, he's a bad guy. Maybe he didn't do this crime, but he did something else that was just as bad. So he should be locked up. And that's just not right.
I mean, the more and more we go through these cases, the more I see what's highlighted is actually some of the corruption in police officers, not so much about people like Darrell, who we see when they go into prison and they, you know, seem to be kind of even doing good work. Some of them are finishing their degrees or starting programs to help other people. And these aren't bad people who are, you know, sitting and kind of rotting in prison. They're trying to do something with their lives still as time passes. And that's kind of what I notice is that highlighted, and also being highlighted is the possibility that some police officers have, you know, corruption, and that it's so easy for them to actually take something out of evidence, use it, because no one looked at the fingerprints. It wasn't even included in any evidence. And it seems almost easy for them to do that, for them to get by without things being thoroughly looked at. And we see this time and time again in all of the cases where evidence is being dismissed or not fully, you know, looked at to completion. And that is what boggles my mind, is how they can actually put someone away for life without foolproof evidence.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is, I mean, what we do know about that particular police department is there was large amounts of cocaine getting stolen from the evidence locker. That's not anything in question. That was happening. Somebody was pled guilty to stealing cocaine from the evidence locker. According to Bruce Gellerman, there was something like 20 or 25 other police officers who may have been involved in stealing cocaine as well. And you think about that, and it's like, this is a city of about 100,000. This isn't Chicago or Boston or, you know, New York. That's a lot of stuff coming out of a small police department's evidence room. And you just kind of wonder what kind of culture that workplace fostered, that people felt comfortable doing this. People who are supposed to be out enforcing the law. But I'm going to throw out a radical notion, and this is my observation from being a reporter for so long, is that I think a lot of times people don't enter the police departments dishonest. I think once they get there and they realize how much power they alone possess, and they surround themselves dealing every day with people who, you know, as police officers are supposed to be dealing with people who are criminals. That's part of their job. It's really hard for that influence not to rub off on you. I'm not saying that it happens to every police officer or anything like that. I know some absolutely wonderful police officers who are very dedicated to what they do and very concerned about justice and are in it for all the right reasons. But in every community I've worked in, I've encountered police officers who there is no way I'd want them anywhere close to a situation where trust was involved.